Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up big, Thanksgiving gatherings may be off the table this year, but we can still have some fun celebrations. We'll talk about how to make the best of the situation, including a great meal for the people in your household. First, Election Day is behind us, but the mental and emotional toll it's taken is still around for many people. Sometimes the stressor disappears, but the stress doesn't. And that's on top of the stress and anxiety from the pandemic and the economic problems it's created. Plus, you know, daily life. It's a good time to remember to exercise our minds, just like we try to exercise our bodies, and think about the power of things like kindness, compassion, and empathy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you dealt with 2020 stress? Have you taken up meditation or some kind of mindfulness practice? Have you found something to help relieve your own stress? In what ways do you try to exercise your mind or practice kindness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Richard Davidson is the William James and Vilas Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin and founder and director of the Center for Healthy Minds. Richard, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So many potential causes of stress this year. What, before we get into some helpful advice, Richard, what is your take on our kind of collective stress and anxiety levels right now?
They're pretty high and pretty significant. The research bears that out. There was a recent paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association reporting that in June of this year compared to June of the previous year, rates of depression are more than three times higher in certain age groups compared to a year ago. And so there's no question that this is a time that is very challenging. I think probably for many of us, the most stressful time we've ever faced in our history.
The pandemic, I think, has had a big baseline anxiety level for a lot of people. I think that may have peaked wherever they are on the political spectrum during the election. The election is over, apart from some court cases now. Does that necessarily mean stress and anxiety are going to fade away if that's what had people worried?
No. I mean, one of the things that makes us distinctively human is that we can create our own stress, so to speak. Our minds can worry about the past and anticipate the future. And as a consequence, we really create a lot of suffering in our own mind after an objective stressor, if you will, goes away, like the election. And so there are many lingering consequences as a function of the capacities of our own mind, which can be both helpful and harmful.
Let's talk about that acute stress situation where whatever the cause is, whether it's politics or worry about the disease, a legitimate, maybe stressful thing. But when it gets to be too much and we start to feel those maybe physical symptoms or we just can't make our minds let go of things, how do we start to be, well, first of all, aware that we're in that state, and then how do we start to ease out of it?
Well, those are great questions, and your intuition that we need to first become aware of it is absolutely true. One of the things that's important to recognize is that if you were a complete couch potato and didn't engage in any physical exercise and your posture was not very good, and someone told you to please stand up straight, and stand that way for a while, you might think it's a good thing to do, but you're simply incapable of doing it because you haven't developed the right muscles. And in the same way, our minds are like that. We can't simply let go of stress because we may agree that it's the right thing to do and that it will be helpful. We may recognize that and yet still be unable to do that because this requires a kind of learning that's different from declarative learning. Declarative learning is learning about things. We can learn the value of letting go of a stressor, but that will not necessarily allow us to let go. We need a second form of learning that we call in neuroscience procedural learning. Procedural learning is more skill-based. It's acquired through practice, and it's implemented in completely different brain circuits. And so we need to exercise our mental and emotional muscles, if you will, just like we exercise our bodily muscles in order to strengthen our capacity for resilience. And we could do this. Resilience is something that can be learned, but we need to practice simple strategies that will enable us to build up these muscles.
We're talking to Richard Davidson from UW-Madison's Center for Healthy Minds, talking about how we can learn to help deal with stress and anxiety. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for Richard Davidson, if you've learned something from him, if you've used the app that he has worked on, or if you found your own solution to help you break out of cycles of stress, 800-642-1234. So, Richard, I can imagine if I want to, you know, learn to hit a baseball, I'll practice swinging a bat. If I want to learn to play the drums, I'll, you know, practice playing the drums. I can't visualize how to exercise my mind in these ways, though. Talk us through some of the first steps.
So some of the first steps involve, as you were implying earlier, becoming aware of what's going on in our minds and our bodies. And there are simple mindfulness exercises that we can use to become more aware of what's actually going on in our minds and our bodies. And the first step in being able to change things and being able to slowly alter our capacity to become resilient is to become aware. And so there are very simple ways of doing it. We can sit quietly for a few minutes and become aware of our breathing. We can become aware of sensations in our body, and we can become aware of our thoughts and understand them as thoughts, not necessarily who we are. We're not our thoughts, yet we have thoughts. It's like a sky contains clouds. It's not made of clouds. We can see the clouds move in the same way our mind has thoughts that can come and go. And if we can see them as thoughts, it can help to disentangle ourselves from our thoughts so that we can see them and we can not get so hijacked by them the next time they come around. So these are simple methods. And you mentioned our app. We have an app that we've developed called the Healthy Minds Program. It's completely freely available, and you can download it from wherever you get your apps. And it's a comprehensive program to train well-being that includes four major elements or constituents. And the first we call awareness. The second is an element that we call connection, which is about qualities that are important for healthy social relationships, qualities like kindness and compassion and appreciation, all of which are so important during this pandemic. The third element we call insight, and insight is about self-knowledge, and it's really about getting curious about how the narrative that we carry around in our mind about ourselves, how that narrative actually works. We, at the extremes end of the distribution, there are people who have a very negative narrative. They have very negative self-beliefs. And part of a healthy mind is not so much changing the narrative, but changing our relationship to the narrative so that we can see the narrative for what it is, which is really a constellation of thoughts. And finally, the last component of well-being is purpose. And purpose is about leaning into our true north, our sense of direction in life, and aligning more and more of our everyday behavior around this sense of purpose. And resilience emerges from the cultivation of each of these four qualities. And there are simple practices that we can do that are on the app that teach people to cultivate each of these four elements of well-being.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Frankel is with us in Grand Marsh. Frankel, hi.
Hi. I found what I do to relieve stress for me that works great is I normally write with my right hand, but I've been teaching myself how to write with my left hand by writing words out of the dictionary. And I'm also in the reading the Bible from cover to cover. God bless.
Thanks a lot for sharing those, Frankel. The first one Richard, that idea of writing with your offhand, it sounds like it's going to take a particular kind of, focus, a kind of intentionality that, is that something that can help us?
It's an interesting strategy. One of the things I frequently remind people is that one size will not fit all. Each person needs to figure out what works best for them. And so there are reasons why writing with your non-dominant hand may be helpful. It's a very absorbing activity. This kind of absorbing activity can actually help with our focus. If it's working for you, that's great.
And are there other thoughts like that, Richard, where, we shake up our routine or approach something in a conscious and different way can help maybe shake us out of the negative cycles of thoughts we might have?
Yeah, in general, I would say that that's true. When things become automatic, when we're on automatic pilot, mm-hmm. our minds frequently get lost. We're not actually aware of what we're doing. There was a study published a number of years ago in a very prestigious journal that asked people through their smartphones with texting them, of course, with their permission. It asked them three questions. The first question is, what are you doing right now? And they checked off from a list of activities. The second question is, where is your mind right now at this moment? And the third question is, right at this moment, how happy or unhappy are you? And this was a study done in more than 3,000 people. And what was found is that the average adult spends 47% of her or his waking life not paying attention to what they're doing. 47% of the time. And when they're not paying attention to what you're doing, these people were significantly less happy. And the title of this scientific paper is A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind. And I think there's something very telling about that. So if we can help to focus our mind, we can improve our well-being.
Thanks for that call, Frankel. We're talking to Richard Davidson, professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison, founder and director of the Center for Healthy Minds. We're talking about how to tend to our mental and emotional health after the election in the midst of the ongoing pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you deal with lingering stress? Have you practiced acts like meditation or other mindfulness activities? How about kindness and compassion? Have you tried the Center for Healthy Minds app yourself? Let us know what you thought of it, how it worked for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Richard Davidson, professor at UW-Madison, founder and director of the Center for Healthy Minds, talking about post-election stress and mental health during the pandemic and how we can help deal with those things. You could join in with your questions and comments, maybe experiences with stress at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Richard, you mentioned one of the parts of the app earlier, dealt with compassion. And that seems like probably a pretty good thing to think about now after a really divisive election in the United States. Talk a little more about the value of focusing on compassion. And you've even told us about, compassion meditation in the past.
Yes, well, it is a very timely topic, particularly in our country today, where there is such divisiveness and quite a bit of difficulty, I think, in different groups that are on the opposite ends of political spectra interacting. And so compassion really is about taking the perspective of another, putting yourself in another person's shoes. And most importantly, it's about recognizing that every human being shares the same wish to be happy and to be free of suffering. We may devise a solution to that that is inconsistent with another person's beliefs. But if we can recognize that people are, for the most part, really trying to do what they believe will be genuinely helpful, I think that we can begin to get past the extraordinary partisanship and expand our in-group and decrease divisiveness. And it's hard. It's not something that I think will come easily. It's also not something that will occur instantaneously. And I think this is an area where ideally we really need to begin in children. We know that kids before the age of about 3 don't make any distinction based on the skin color of another child in terms of their liking of another child, in terms of their trusting of another child, in terms of their willingness to share with another child. After that age, we begin to develop prejudices as a consequence of the culture in which we reside. If we can start early on in life, ideally, and teach children to cultivate kindness and compassion and to build on the propensity that they have early on to begin with, where they don't make distinctions based on the kind of distinctions that are the hallmark of prejudice later in life, I think that we can really help to heal the divide that is so pernicious now in our country. For us adults, it doesn't mean we can't also do things that will be helpful. One of the practices in our app and that's taught very frequently to cultivate compassion is we begin with our in-group. We begin by reflecting on people that are very close to us. It could be our family members, our very, very close friends, our spouses, our children, and bring them into our mind and our heart and envision a time when they may have been having some difficulty and cultivate the strong aspiration that they be relieved of that difficulty, of that suffering. And then we gradually begin to expand that so we can go from a loved one to ourselves. It's often hard to do this for ourselves. We can then move on to a person that we might not know very well. It could be a person who is a neighbor that lives near us. We see them on a regular basis. We don't know much about them. It might be someone who works in the same building that we work in or attends the same class, but we don't know much about them. And imagine a time in their life when they may have been having difficulty, even if you don't know about their life in any detail. And then cultivate this strong aspiration that they be relieved of that suffering. And then finally, we move on to the category of person that is what we might call a difficult person, someone who pushes our buttons, not someone who gets us the most angry, but someone who annoys us in whatever way, and then bring them into our mind and our heart in a genuine way. And imagine that they're just like you, that they have the same wish to be happy and to be free of suffering. And imagine a time when they may have been having some difficulty and cultivate that same aspiration that they be relieved of that difficulty. And I think that that kind of practice, in fact, we know from scientific evidence that this is a kind of practice that can actually decrease hard-nosed measures of implicit bias. Mm-hmm. Bias that really gets under the skin that's cellular. And so this is a kind of practice which I think is so important during this time that we are all confronting in our nation today.
I want to bring on another caller. Mike is with us in Stoughton. Mike, hi.
Hi, Richard. I just wanted to say thank you to Richard. I've had the app for about 6 months, and then I signed up for the master's course that you and your colleagues are presenting right now. Actually, it's tonight again. It's just really helped me and changed my narrative. And like you said, the other things is it's challenged some of my beliefs. And my wife is pretty happy with it because one of the lessons or one of the work things are about the way you say something. And I've been married many, many years, and she always says, you know, you said that the way you said it. And so I'm really aware now of the way I say things. I wasn't self-aware that I said things in a nasty tone. Tone that was sarcastic. And I thought she was just really sensitive to that. And sure enough, I totally changed the way that my tone to her, and she just loves it.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We just have a minute or so left, Richard. Yeah, a quick response.
Well, it's beautiful, Mike. Thank you so much. And I'm really happy to hear that you're finding this of value. And the way you describe it, I think, is so perfect. And the fact that your wife is commenting on it is a real testament to the change that's occurring. Wonderful. Keep it up.
And I've been poking around, Richie. You can find the Healthy Minds program app wherever you find any of your other apps, right?
That's right. Yeah. And if you go to the website, tryhealthyminds.org, so tryhealthyminds, all one word, .org, you can learn more about the app.
Thanks for that call. And Richard, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
It is a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Richard Davidson is the William James and Vilas Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at the UW-Madison and founder and director of the Center for Healthy Minds. We talked about how to find some moments of peace of mind in our post-election and still pandemic world. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with America's Test Kitchen about how to prepare a great, small-scale Thanksgiving dinner and make our quarantined holiday feel special. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, 2020 has been a big year in political misinformation and disinformation, especially on social media, and it's gone through the roof since Election Day. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the flow of intentionally misleading info and what to do about it. That's tomorrow morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. Now, to limit the spread of COVID-19, state officials are urging people in Wisconsin to stay home this Thanksgiving and avoid the big traditional gatherings. They're not saying don't celebrate at all. Among their ideas, have virtual gatherings, deliver food and treats to loved ones in a way that avoids contact, maybe shop online, watch sports and other stuff on the TV. Governor Evers says, while difficult, the actions we take now will ensure we can celebrate together later. We thought it'd be a good time to talk about some ways to make our holiday more fun and how to make a small Thanksgiving dinner. Who needs an entire bird for just two people, say? Well, good news, America's Test Kitchen is on top of both of those angles. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How have you adjusted your Thanksgiving plans? Do you have some fun ideas to make the day more special? Big virtual dinner, and what is on your menu? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Brian Roof is the executive food editor for Cook's Country magazine and an on-screen test cook for the public TV show Cook's Country. They're part of the America's Test Kitchen franchise. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me, man.
Well, are you ready for a small, quiet Thanksgiving yourself?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of welcoming it. It's going to be a nice change. I usually have a ton of people here. And so I'm actually looking forward to having something a little bit more quiet and subdued, but still, you know, packed with a lot of good food and a lot of fun just for the immediate family. So, yeah, it'll
now,
be all right.
In my household, you know, there's four of us, and I got to say we have not arrived at a conclusion of what we want to make on Thanksgiving. Do you have your menu roughly lined up yet?
You know, it's mostly set in place. I mean, I have a few key items like, rather than turkey, I always smoke ducks. That's a big thing in my family. And, aside from that, there'll be cornbread stuffing, but aside from those two things, you know, we're going to kind of keep it loose, and I'm going to let the kids pick out some items that they'd like to try. And I'm going to get them involved in the kitchen as well to kind of spread the fun out.
Well, that reminds me, America's Test Kitchen posted a bunch of ideas on how to make Thanksgiving more fun. We've got a link over at WPR.org/Central Time. And you just said one of them, make cooking a team effort, get everybody, kids included, involved in the process. Talk more about why you wanted to do that.
Well, my kids already have this attachment to cooking, you know, because they live with me and I cook all the time. But they actually enjoy it. They enjoy getting in there, getting their hands dirty. I have two of them that absolutely love desserts, and I don't know if you've ever made pies or desserts in general, but they take a lot of time. So that's a good way to keep them occupied for several hours at a time. So that's always nice. And then I have one kid who's just absolutely enamored with savory cooking. So, you know, he jumps in and gets creative. And I think at a time like this, when you're not having a big crowd, you don't have to stress about, you know, hitting all the sweet spots for your uncle that's coming over and he always wants gravy. You know, I think now is a good time to let people experiment with the menu, and bringing the kids into the kitchen and letting them have a say in what you're making is a real good way to do that.
Part of the fun of Thanksgiving, I think, sometimes is the production that goes into it. Is this a good time to maybe make that thing that we wouldn't, you know, rush to make on a dinner starting at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, on a normal Wednesday? We could still put some effort into it, even if it's not producing mass quantities of turkey, say.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, even more reason. You know, there's no pressure on this day, really. You don't have a bunch of people coming over. So you can think of it as just any other weekend dinner. You know, it's like a Saturday dinner. Maybe you're going to start preparing a little bit earlier. Maybe you're going to pick a recipe that takes a little bit more effort. But in general, I think you're going to have the time to make it, and you don't have to make a great quantity. So it's going to turn into, you know, a slightly easier project than biting off a whole massive Thanksgiving dinner for a lot of people.
We are talking about making a fun, but if downsized, Thanksgiving event, a meal and beyond. Brian Roof is with us from Cook's Country Magazine and the public TV show Cook's Country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you changing your Thanksgiving plans? What is on the menu? Are you doing all the traditional favorites or trying something new? And are you doing things to make it more fun, even if it's not as many people as usual, or to make it a big event, maybe with online connection with others? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Another suggestion, Brian, from that list that we linked to at WPR.org/Central Time is the idea of having a signature beverage to make the meal a little more special. What kind of things can we think about?
Well, you know, obviously, when you say signature beverage, we all think of cocktails. But, you know, if it's just you and your spouse, then, and you have a bunch of kids around your house like I do, then you're going to have to come up with a great mocktail. You know, something, no alcohol, but the kids will really enjoy. So I just take a ton of different juices, mix them up, and keep them in the fridge all day, and, you know, garnish them really fancy with some umbrellas or something so the kids feel like they're really involved in, you know, having a little bit of fun with that. But in general, my wife and I will either crack open a bottle of wine, or we'll make a special cocktail for us, you know, similar to what we make for the kids, but with alcohol in ours.
Well, we've got a few recipes from America's Test Kitchen. We've got them posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. And one of them answers the question of, hey, I want turkey on Thanksgiving. I don't want to make a whole turkey for not many people. This is a slow cooker turkey breast. By the way, our producer, Bill Martins, says he made this a few years ago. It was fantastic, and he's doing it this year. What's the key to getting a really good, flavorful turkey breast in the slow cooker?
Well, the slow cooker gets a bad rap a lot of the times, but it's actually the perfect way to cook your turkey breast because it's a low temperature environment. It's steamy, so you gently bring the meat up to temperature. You know, the recipe that you're talking about has, you know, aggressive seasoning on the bird under the skin, and it makes a really flavorful gravy. So really, the key is just to follow that recipe. The recipe takes care of itself, and you know, you're not going to save any time, but you know, cooking a turkey in the oven takes you 4 hours anyway. So, by doing this, you free up your oven space to make a pie or to make sweet potatoes or whatever else you might be making that day. So it's a solid recipe.
I just did a turkey actually in the crock pot this last weekend, not as a special meal. I got one of those, they call it a turkey tenderloin, and I think it's pre-marinated. The America's Test Kitchen recipe, and I might follow up on this, says don't get necessarily those pre-marinated ones. What kind of things do you do to prep the turkey breast?
You know, for me in general, I tend to recommend just salt. It's a safe bet. If you want to add herbs, thyme or rosemary, always great, and pepper. But in general, keep it simple. You can change up your accompanying sauce. And rather than doing a gravy, you could do some kind of a chimichurri, like the Argentine parsley cilantro sauce to kind of mix it up. But in general, salt it overnight. That salt really helps change the structure of the proteins so that turkey, as it cooks, holds on to more moisture. And it also obviously seasons the turkey. But yeah, salt is key. Do that a day ahead if you can. And then if you want to mix it up, you can also throw on other spices like a Cajun spice rub or Greek seasoning rub. The turkey is really, it's kind of a blank canvas. So you could really have fun with it. Whatever you typically enjoy in your normal day-to-day out of your spice cabinet, you could add to the turkey.
And then with the turkey, there's a good chance we'll want some potatoes. And another recipe we've posted from you all is the garlic parmesan mashed potatoes. I like the sound of it. Walk us through the basic concept here.
Yeah, so this is a great recipe because it pulls out an ingredient that I think all of us have in our spice cabinet, but we're all kind of embarrassed to use, and that's garlic powder. So the great
I'm
thing here is that I love this stuff. I grew up with it. So the great thing here is that, one, that we use it. Two, that you get two different levels of garlic flavor in these mashed potatoes. So we take a little bit of garlic powder. We activate it with a little bit of water, make a paste with it. And then we also add fresh garlic to this potato. So the potatoes are just simply boiled, and you process them through a ricer, which is like a giant garlic press, if you will. And so they're nice and smooth, but you could also just mash them up with a regular old potato masher, add a little bit of butter, the garlic powder that's now turned into a paste, and some fresh minced garlic along with some milk. And it's super easy recipe. I mean, and the great thing about it is it doesn't make a ton. It's just perfect for a smaller Thanksgiving like this year.
Sounds great. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hey, this is a great conversation. My significant other and I have been doing two-person Thanksgivings for years. And we love the cooking process, and we make a 25-pound turkey.
Wow.
We enjoy cooking throughout the day. And then we have Thanksgiving for, you know, we freeze little pieces of it, and you have great meals in the future until Christmas. And so I don't think you should change anything. Continue to enjoy the pies, the stuffings, the gravies, and just do as you normally do.
I love it, Michael. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. So that is another way to go, Brian. Still go all out, still cook the same amount of stuff, and then freeze it and keep pulling it out through the next month or two.
Mm-hmm. I have to say it's a pretty good idea, and I pretty much agree with him. I mean, especially in my case, when I do those ducks, it's something I do once a year. So I'm going to make extra, and I don't mind eating that same meal, you know, at least for the next 3 or 4 days. But freezing it, we've done that in the past, especially with the stuffing. I think it's a great move. You know, I don't tend to keep anything in the freezer for longer than 2 months, you know, so I wouldn't freeze a great quantity of it. But, you know, because after 2 months, it starts to affect the flavor of the food. But I think that's a good idea.
Michael, thanks for that call. Yeah, we're talking about how to have a great smaller scale Thanksgiving. Brian Roof is with us from America's Test Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your Thanksgiving plans? How have they changed this year? Or, like our last caller, do you usually keep it small anyway? Are you going to video chat with friends and family? How do you plan on making the day fun and special? And, of course, what's on your menu? Or do you have a question for our guest about what to make? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Find a few recipes. We've got some turkey breast in the slow cooker, garlic parmesan mashed potatoes, and pecan pie. Find them at WPR.org/Central Time. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now on how to celebrate Thanksgiving this year because of the pandemic. Health officials are saying you're best off staying home, limiting gatherings to the people you live with. Brian Roof is our guest. He's got some ideas to help make that a fun meal. He's executive food editor for Cook's Country magazine and on-screen test cook for the public TV show Cook's Country. And you can join in. Tell us what you are looking at doing on Thanksgiving. How are you going to try to make that smaller gathering fun? And what is on the menu? Or call in with a question. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Russ is with us in Stoughton. Russ, hi.
Hi. I have two suggestions. The first one is for what you drink at the Thanksgiving table. Years ago, our family, which wasn't big wine drinkers, and normally you might have some kind of a light white wine with turkey or fowl, and we switched over to sparkling white grape, which tastes amazingly like wine, and you can barely tell the difference. And you don't have to worry about driving home if you had too much sparkling grape.
That does make it special. You said you had two suggestions, Russ?
Yeah. Years ago, my sister, who lives by herself, and I do now, and I won't be going down to Illinois to see my sons this year, she makes she gets a full-size, just a turkey breast, and she stuffs it, and I do too. And what she discovered from some recipe from somebody years back is she takes a room temperature stick of butter, rubs the entire inside and outside of a typical brown grocery bag, shoves the turkey breast in there with some butter pads and maybe some water, and then she staples the end shut, shoves it in the oven, and it comes out perfect every time.
Wow.
I don't know what the times are, but it decreases the cooking time, that's for sure.
Russ, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Brian, have you heard of that, turkey in a bag?
You know, I've heard of turkey in one of those clear oven bags, the plastic-type bags, but I've never heard of it in a paper bag. I've heard of apple pie in a paper bag, but never a turkey. I would just say that I think that's an exciting idea, and I would love to try it. I think just from my experience with the apple pie in the bag is that you have to make sure that there's no print on the outside of that bag, because that could be a little slightly toxic, but don't let that ruin your Thanksgiving either, but that's an interesting idea.
And something as simple as, and that was a big hit for my kids for a long time, like sparkling cider, sparkling grape juice, it doesn't really cost that much in the scope of things for a meal, less than wine, but it does make it feel a little fancier, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, fancy glasses, little garnishes in the cups or stemmed wine glasses, I think. Yeah, it helps, make the day feel a little bit more special, especially for the kids.
Now, you mentioned the apple pie. Well, you've given us a recipe at America's Test Kitchen for pecan pie or pecan pie. I've heard both. I think I say both.
Yeah.
How do you say it? And tell us a little bit about the pie.
Right. I say a pecan pie. I had to do an interview with Georgia Public Television at one point, and I really made sure I knew how to say it before I met with the folks from Georgia. The pecan pie, this is a fantastic recipe. It's one of our older recipes in the America's Test Kitchen archive. And it's, stood the test of time because it is fantastic. It's simple. The hardest part of the recipe is actually just dealing with pie crust, but if you have the time to mess around with it, and the recipe instructions are very clear and simple, it's a fantastic recipe. And we even have recipes for chocolate pecan pie on the website too that people should check out.
Ooh, I like the sound of that. Let's go to Allison with us now in Menominee Falls. Allison, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about Allison?
I am, first of all, a huge Test Kitchen fan, so I'm excited to speak to anybody from the Test Kitchen and speak to professionals, but I'd love advice on things that I could whole roast this season. I'm hosting for the first time, and I'm hosting for my husband and my two kids. So it's not a big family like we usually get together, but it's looking different. But I'm excited to try something new and try new recipes.
And are you looking to roast a big piece of meat, Allison? Is that what you're looking for here?
Well, I was thinking a bird is kind of, you know, what you usually would cook, but I'm interested in doing something maybe a little different, like whole roasting a branzino or something of that fare.
Okay, Allison, thanks. There's your challenge. Brian, give us Allison some inspiration for maybe some counter programming on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great idea. Like I said before, this is actually a perfect time for people who don't always want to have the standard Thanksgiving meal to start experimenting a little bit. So I think we've got some recipe for whole roasted fish at the ATK website. That I think is a fantastic idea. Prime rib is always nice. I mean, we just, in the most recent issue of Cook's Country, came out with one of the easiest boneless prime rib recipes we've ever done. It's you just set the oven, turn it off after a few minutes, and just let the thing glide up to a perfect medium rare. So that's a fun one. You know, and don't overlook whole roasted chicken. I know it sounds boring, but there's something really, really nice, especially if you just have four or five people, about doing a perfectly roasted whole chicken. Seasoned aggressively, make a nice fancy sauce for it. Like I said earlier, a chimichurri goes wonderful with that. But yeah, I think any of those items, a pork loin is pretty affordable, and pork loin with 40 cloves of garlic or something would be nice. And that's got that whole appeal of bring a big fat roast to the table. So any of those items I think would be wonderful.
All right. Hope that helps, Allison. And Brian, my pratfall with roasting that chicken is sometimes it comes out a little dry when I do it. How do we avoid that?
Well, you know what? I have this thing and at one point when I visited Madison, I had this conversation with one of your local chefs there, and he swore up and down that there was no perfect way to roast a chicken. And I disagree with him with all due respect, you know, but you know, you just have to monitor. You have to get yourself a reliable thermometer, and you have to temp it. You know, I roast a chicken many different ways, but in general, I throw it into a 400 degree oven and I buy about a 4 pound bird. Throw it into a 400 degree oven, and on average, it takes about 1 hour to cook. You want to temp it in the thigh to make sure the thigh comes up to temperature, and that's the most important part there because the breast will tend to cook pretty quickly. But you want to bring that thigh joint up to about 175 degrees, and at that point, the breast should simultaneously reach its desired temperature of 160 degrees. Then you pull it out, let it sit for about 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. You have some time there because it's still pretty hot. And, you know, I would say that I've never really encountered a dry one. You know, I have pretty good luck with it. So,
excellent. In our last few moments, Brian, do you have plans to reach out to other people, even if you're not gathering in person on the holiday itself?
Yeah, you know, we're going to do, I just spoke about the desserts earlier that my kids are going to make, and we're going to do a dessert drop-off and some side dish exchanges with some of our friends, you know, at a safe distance. You know, we're going to Zoom with some of my siblings and my cousins, you know, just to kind of connect with everybody. We won't spend, you know, hours on end doing it, but just a little pop online to say, you know, hello to everybody and wish you well. And then, you know, I think when we're in the backyard, we'll see our neighbors and give them a wave. And we always have oysters and cold beer out there. So we'll probably bring them a little care platter, you know, to share.
Sounds great.
At a safe distance.
Sounds great, Brian. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much, man. Take care.
You too. That was Brian Roof with America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. Or make sure our producers give him my address for that dessert drop-off. We talked to him about how to plan a smaller scale Thanksgiving dinner and make the day feel special. Find three recipes they shared at WPR.org/food Friday. Slow cooker turkey breast with gravy, garlic parmesan mashed potatoes, and perfect pecan pie. You can also find a list of great ideas to make Thanksgiving fun at WPR.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest stories in national politics, including Trump campaign election lawsuits, with many suits dropped or revised over the last week. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Here's a mystery with a bit of a shine to it. Following up on a conversation we had early last year, we talked to a researcher at Northland College in Ashland who had discovered by accident that flying squirrels in his neighborhood glowed when you shined ultraviolet light on them. He joined the show to tell us about it, and it's kind of a mystery. It's not common for us mammals to have this kind of glow in any light. He thought it might have something to do with their nocturnal lifestyle. Now, an update, as reported in the New York Times, the platypus, already kind of an odd creature in the mammal world because it has a duck-like bill, webbed feet, and lays eggs, but somehow is still a mammal. Well, it turns out it glows in ultraviolet light, too. The flying squirrels here in Wisconsin shined pink in the UV, the platypus more of a greenish blue. That same Northland College researcher, Eric Olson, made the discovery. He and colleagues went to the Field Museum in Chicago to shine UV lights on flying squirrel specimens. And hey, while they were there, they tried it out on the platypus, and whoop, there it is, a glow. And this summer, a researcher in Australia confirmed the discovery in the wild. But why? What's in it for a platypus, or a flying squirrel for that matter, to glow in ultraviolet light? No one really knows. It'll be up to future research to shine a light on the question. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.